The worry, I think, is the wind pushing that fire. Several departments are on scene or responding.
A large fire threatens homes in Palmer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 29th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Congress considers major changes to the tax code.
You tell me anybody's happy with the way the tax system is established today, and I'll show you an idiot.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
A fire whipped by 50-mile-an-hour winds is threatening a Palmer subdivision and is spreading beyond it. Residents are being evacuated at this hour. The fire was caused by a vehicle wreck on the Glen Highway earlier this afternoon. According to Matanuska Susitna Borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan, initial reports show the fire is spreading, and although right now it is threatening homes, none are ablaze.
Earlier in the day, firefighters asked residents to evacuate, and the fire is moving around to some new areas in Bayland Loop, Joshua Road, and Pioneer Parkway. These roads are near the Valley Trails subdivision. The school district was alerted early, and kids were held either at school or the school bus didn't, deliver the kids to that neighborhood.
Sullivan says there are about 15 homes in the threatened Cedar Hills subdivision. Evacuations began earlier this afternoon. The Palmer Fire Department is leading the fire suppression effort, but help is coming in from firefighters all over the region. The Anchorage Fire Department has sent 3 engines, a deputy chief and a battalion chief, a total of 12 people from Eagle River and downtown and the Campbell Airstrip stations. The State Division of Forestry has 5 engines at the Palmer Fishhook Road fire site, and a shelter is being established in Palmer, and the Palmer Senior Center is being used as an emergency command post. The fire was started when a truck hauling a trailer caught fire after an accident on the Glen near the Palmer Fishhook Road. So far, no injuries have been reported in this emergency situation. The fiscal cliff, that much reported on combination of tax increases and government spending cuts, is less than 5 weeks away. But as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, most lawmakers are talking about sweeping tax reforms, something unlikely to happen before the end of the year.
Most people agree on the need to overhaul the U.S. tax code, including U.S. Representative Don Young.
You tell me anybody's happy with the way the tax system is established today, and I'll show you an idiot.
Congressman Young was in D.C. the last time Congress reformed the tax code. That 1986 measure established many of the current income and corporate rates we have today, and it affirmed many of the deductions businesses and people enjoy. Many of them, from the deduction for home mortgage interest to a 2% payroll tax cut, are on the chopping block. Closing loopholes and capping the amount of deductions a person can claim is an option publicly floated by Republicans in Washington. Most Republicans still oppose increasing personal tax rates, but some have been offering a conciliatory tone since the election.
Let's look at new revenue, and I'm not limiting it to just closing off loopholes at a certain level.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is one of a growing number of Republicans who are willing to offer increased tax rates in negotiations. She insists that higher rates must come with significant reforms to Medicare and Medicaid.
It may be that at the end of the day, what we're looking at is an increase on tax rates at the very, very, very highest level. Now, the president seems to be stuck on those that make over $250,000. I'm very concerned that that traps too many of those small businesses who would then see a tax rate increase.
Senator Murkowski says it's too early to speculate on what a final package would look like, whether the rates would increase on people making $250,000 or $500,000 or even $1 million per year. She says that Republican senators are briefed regularly by their leaders, those closest to the negotiations with the White House. But by and large, most senators are not crafting the reform package. Senator Mark Begich has his own plan, one that would reduce the amount of personal tax brackets from 6 to 3 and create a flat 24% corporate rate.
Well, if you lower the rates, you got to pay for that drop. And the way you pay for that is clean up the system. There is just a shopping list of these type of loopholes. But at the end of the day, if you can flatten the rate so our corporate structure is more competitive worldwide, then that's a plus.
He says he expects a lobbying bonanza when the true reform begins in earnest.
I know what's going to happen as soon as we move that forward, too. You're going to hear complaints from every special interest group saying, well, why did you reduce mine? Well, in order to get to their lower rate that they all clamor for, you have to do that.
Senator Begich says his plan is gaining Republican support, though it hasn't had a committee vote or received a cost analysis from the Congressional Budget Office. He says that he's talked with Majority Leader Harry Reid about incorporating certain elements of the plan into a reform package. All the talk of tax reform in Congress may be for naught if President Barack Obama and Speaker John Boehner cannot reach a compromise on the fiscal cliff. While those two meet in private, Congress is left trying to work in a bipartisan way. Senator Murkowski says the spirit of compromise since the election has not lasted as long as many would have liked.
We may decide that it's not going to be by closing off the loopholes, or it will absolutely not be with increased rates. But what seems to me to be happening around here more often than not is people saying, well, everything is on the table, and then they take off 2 of the 4 items before we've even started the conversation.
And by some accounts, that's already happening between the president and speaker. We won't know if that happens in Congress until there's actually a tax reform bill. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The National Park Service this week released the results of this year's fall wolf count. The final numbers indicate that the wolf population in Denali National Park and Preserve has fallen by 61% since an all-time high 147 wolves were counted in 2007. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Counting wolves is not for people with motion sickness, vertigo, or a fear of flying.
You're circling repeatedly, and you know you might feel the bumps up and down. Your stomach can lurch a little bit.
Bridget Borg is a wildlife biologist with the National Park Service. This week, the agency released the results from their fall season aerial wolf surveys in Denali National Park and Preserve.
So far, what our counts are on, you know, the lower end, but not necessarily outside of the range of natural variation.
The Park Service counted 57 wolves in 9 packs that live inside the park. It's the second lowest count since the Park Service began surveying the wolf population in 1986. But Borg says there are a number of factors that affect the region's wolf population.
The numbers reflect underlying ecological and natural variation. Now, in years with less snow, like right now, it's really easy for caribou to get around, to get to food sources. And so when wolves are traveling around and looking for, you know, available prey, it might be a little bit more difficult for them to find it because the caribou that they do encounter are in good condition.
Wildlife advocates argue that low numbers this fall confirm their fears about the decline of the Denali region wolf population. Conservation organizations in the state filed 3 petitions with the Alaska Board of Game over the summer to reestablish a protective buffer for wolves along the northeastern boundary of the park. The petitions were denied. The groups argue that the board prioritizes sport hunting and trapping in the region, but the board says there's no scientific evidence that the wolf population in the Denali area faces a critical decline. Bridget Borg says the fall count does not include uncollared wolf packs that might live inside the park boundary. The Park Service will continue surveying wolves this winter. The agency also conducts regular aerial surveys in the spring. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Conservation biologist Rick Steiner sent a request this week to Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell asking for an emergency order that would close state lands east of Denali National Park to hunting and trapping wolves. The season opened November 1st. Steiner made a similar request last May after Park Service biologists reported the dispersal of the Grant Creek wolf pack. The pack did not produce pups this year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Savunga celebrates a whale that may be a record setter.
If we can roll it over, the D9 tractor can probably roll it in so people can work on it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
An Anchorage Democratic senator has retained his seat in the state Senate. The Division of Elections says a recount of votes in Senate District J today shows incumbent Hollis French as the winner, defeating Republican Bob Bell. Division Director Gail Finumiai certified the election last week, with French holding a 51-vote lead. Bell on Monday asked for the recount. The recount widened the gap to 59 votes. Scientists say they have resolved one of the biggest arguments in the climate change debate. In a report published in Science magazine today, they present a new comprehensive analysis of how much the giant ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica have been melting and how much that adds to the rise of the world's oceans. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
11 centimeters, about half an inch. That's the estimate for how much the oceans have gone up since 1992 because the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets are melting. Andrew Shepard of the University of Leeds led a scientific team that reconciled all the remote sensing and estimates and answered the big question of whether snowfall is increasing fast enough to replace decay of the ice sheets at the edges. That's called the mass balance uncertainty. And there is less uncertainty now, announced Shepard at a press briefing yesterday.
This improved certainty allows us to state definitively that both Antarctica and Greenland have been losing ice.
The Antarctic ice sheet is growing on the east side, but melting away on the west. Some years that balances, and some years there's more melt than increase. For Greenland, the answer is more definitive, says Dr. Eric Ivins of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. There should be no more dispute about whether Greenland has been losing ice for the past 20 years.
I would say that we have reduced that uncertainty that existed in the 1990s for Greenland quite a bit. So those controversies have apparently collapsed quite a bit.
And the ice loss from Greenland has been increasing.
If we compare data from the 1990s to those over the last decade, it would appear as though Greenland is losing mass at about five times the rate today as it was in the early 1990s.
Ivins went on to say that this has huge implications for storm surges, such as New York City experienced with Hurricane Sandy. Even a half inch more ocean adds up to a large mass that can power waves to travel far inland. The scientists refuse to speculate about future ice sheet melt, saying that's for the computer modelers to do. All they've done is improve the raw data the modelers work with. But Michel van den Broekie of Utrecht University was willing to say that glacier melt has already increased to the point that it is effectively doubling the expansion of the waters due to higher temperatures.
I think it's fair to say that the big ice sheets have caught up in the recent decades and are now among the most important contributions to sea level rise.
The study team also stressed the need for better satellite coverage, particularly with synthetic aperture radar. Most of the satellites using that are no longer in service. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska's chronic shortage of substance abuse detoxification services recently improved when one of four residential detox centers in the state reopened. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
The Ernie Turner Center in Anchorage closed its detox program in late July when it learned it didn't comply with a 2009 advisory from the State Board of Nursing clarifying what services licensed practical nurses, or LPNs, can provide. Rebecca Ling is Director of Recovery Services at Cook Inlet Tribal Council, which manages the Ernie Turner Center.
We were able to get some clarification from the nursing board on staffing patterns, and we hired two nurses to do admits during the daytime, and our LPNs work at night. So we're in compliance.
And how much extra is this costing?
We believe the additional staffing patterns are going to cost approximately $180,000 more per year.
And where are you getting that money from?
We're working with the state to try to get additional fundings for those charges.
The Ernie Turner Center has 12 beds for detox services, which together with beds at other programs adds up to 38 in Alaska. Ling says they have one vacancy now and a waiting list of 12, which she expects to grow as word spreads they've reopened their detox services. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The executive director of Beans Cafe died early this morning of pneumonia. 64-year-old Jim Crockett helped start the Anchorage Cafe in 1979. It provides meals, shelter, and support services for the city's neediest citizens. KSKA's Stacia Eaton has more.
Jim Crockett was a founding board member of Beans Cafe in downtown Anchorage. Leslie Ellis is the chairwoman of the board that oversees Beans. She says Crockett's leadership will be missed.
A little more than 10 years ago, the position of executive director became open, and he applied, and he was, of course, the perfect fit, and we were thrilled. You know, Jim is very unique because he's compassionate, he's caring, but he was an excellent financial manager.
Crockett worked in the private sector as an accountant and financial manager before becoming the director of Beans, Ellis says. He'll be remembered, she says, for expanding the work of the cafe. Under Crockett's leadership, Beans began serving around 800 meals a day within the cafe, plus 100 to 200 additional meals at other locations. The cafe also began providing shelter when the Brother Francis shelter filled up. One of the biggest things that happened during Crockett's tenure, Ellis says, is the creation of a sub-program of Beans called Children's Lunchbox, which serves over 1,200 kids lunch every day at six locations. Ellis says the Beans staff and volunteers are honoring Crockett by carrying on that work.
This is a really sad day for us, but our staff and the large number of volunteers we have every day that make things happen at Beans and Children's Lunchbox, all were at work today. Everybody's working. There was no interruption in service. That would be the one thing Jim would not want to see happen, and I'm proud to say that it's a hard day, but everybody has stepped up and made things happen.
Ellis says because Crockett died so suddenly, a memorial service hasn't been planned yet, but the board is considering ways to honor Crockett and will release information about how the community can remember him soon. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
From a young age, kids learn how to stay safe. They memorize their phone numbers, learn about stranger danger, wear helmets when they ride bikes. But some of the things they learn are more subtle, like to trust their intuition. Yesterday, we explored prevention programs in Sitka that aim to build resiliency in young kids through group activities. Today, we'll take a look at how lessons learned in childhood might break the cycle of domestic violence. KCAW's Ann Bryce reports.
Elena's going to talk to us about some different types of touches.
We are in a third grade classroom at Kikushihin Elementary School. Students are learning about the difference between good and bad touch, a lesson many of us might remember from growing up.
Who has an idea of what a safe touch might be? Can anybody give me an example? Yeah, maybe a pat out of the back. Yeah, exactly.
Elena Gustafson is a youth outreach coordinator at the local women's shelter, Sitkins Against Family Violence, or SAFE. She's teaching a class about personal safety.
Hugs, high fives, handshakes, pats on the back. How do all of these touches make us feel? They make us feel good. Yeah, they make us feel safe. If you get a high five from somebody, maybe you might feel proud. So these typically make us feel really good.
Being a young child can be a confusing time, and life lessons can seem contradictory. Kids are taught to be polite and respect authority, but also not to talk to strangers. This class focuses on teaching kids to pay attention to how a touch or situation makes them feel.
And an uh-oh feeling is a feeling in your tummy that, you know, something just isn't right.
Diana Twaddle is a counselor at the elementary school. By having open discussions with kids, the hope is it'll give children the tools they need to deal with tough situations they may encounter.
You can always say no thank you to any touch because you are each the boss of your body.
Gustafson and Twaddle will visit every classroom at Keat to give a safety talk. They hope that by empowering kids to stand up for themselves, they're able to decrease violence in future generations. Children who experience trauma are not only much more likely to become the perpetrators or victims of violence, they're also more likely to develop a slew of other problems later in life.
Lung disease and heart disease and substance abuse issues and mental health problems, smoking, alcoholism, IV drug use, unwanted or teen pregnancy, STDs.
These ailments are a medical outcome of what most agree is a serious social epidemic. Alaska has one of the highest domestic violence rates in the nation. Nearly half of Alaska's women have experienced intimate partner violence in their lifetime. That puts the state third, behind Oklahoma and Nevada, but well above the national average of about 36%. While teaching children about boundaries is a critical step in addressing domestic violence, so is enforcing those boundaries later in life.
If we can get kids out of those households and get their parents to feel like they safely can get out of those households, then we are hopefully ending the problem in the future.
Christine McLeod-Pate is an attorney. She works for the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, a coalition of 18 programs that help abuse victims across the state. The coalition has been running a pro bono program for shelters in Alaska for the last 15 years. But not everyone who needs legal support can get it. Pate says nearly 200 people apply for legal representation, and the network is only able to provide services to about half of them. That leaves 100 people who have to represent themselves in court.
I think there's something wrong with a system where you can go to court, you know, facing severe safety concerns or facing the potential loss of access to your child, and not have a right to an attorney if you can't afford one.
She says that even if someone isn't directly affected by domestic violence, everyone pays a steep price. Children who grow up in violent homes often require more help and resources, like special education in schools, extra police protection, and more use of the court system.
This is something that really, if it's not emotionally affecting you, it's certainly affecting everybody's pocketbook.
You're not sure if it's quite right. What would you do?
Alaska's governor has made domestic violence a top law enforcement priority, and intervention and education are on the rise in the state. But those delivering the services wonder if it's enough. Gustafson and Twaddle give a personal safety lesson to each class only once a year at the elementary school, and only half of domestic violence victims in Alaska who seek free legal help can actually get it. Follow-up studies in rural communities like Sitka may eventually show that early intervention programs work to reduce the rate of domestic violence. But for now, it remains a matter of teaching and hoping.
I love what you added to that, asking if you can give somebody a handshake, or asking somebody if you can give them a hug, right? Asking helps make it a safe touch, because then somebody always has the option to say, no, thank you.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ann Bryce.
Savonga celebrated a successful whale strike earlier this week, just as the 2012 whale season is coming to a close, and the bowhead could be one for the record books. KNOM's Margaret DeMaribus reports.
Onlookers gathered in Savanga yesterday to watch the community's last whale of the season get moved toward the beach. Estimates are showing this could be one of the biggest whales caught in Savanga, and it is requiring a lot of strength by both man and machine to move it out of the water. George Nunguk is from Savanga. He is the chairman of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission and is a representative for the Alaska Commission in the international whaling arena. Nunguk says that a technique has been devised to estimate a whale's length by measuring flukes and jawbone. He says this technique is based on documented samples and measurements from bowhead whales harvested in Alaska whaling communities.
Probably safe to say that with the measurement of flukes being over 21 feet, you take that and multiply that by three and get an estimate around 63 feet.
Nunguk says Captain Frederick Kingikuk and his crew struck the whale just before daybreak on Tuesday. Community members were busy trying to roll it to shore yesterday after the flukes sheared during the initial attempt to pull it out of the water. They had worked late into the night Tuesday and continued efforts yesterday. Nunguk says it may take a while.
Earlier today, they were able to make a ramp out to the whale, and that's what we're trying to do right now, to roll it over. If we can roll it over, the D9 tractor can probably roll it in so people can work on it.
He says communities are dependent upon bowhead whales and explains the importance of subsistence hunting.
I think number one is the food security. The bowhead whale is central for most of our whaling communities in Alaska, and it's very important for them to get the bowhead so they can feed their communities and families.
He also shares the many ways hunting impacts community members.
Culturally, mentally, physically, it's important. Biologically, it's important. So all those factors combined makes it a very important resource.
Nunguk emphasizes that bowhead whales are a shared quota and a shared resource, a practice that's always happened with whaling in Alaskan communities.
KNOM's Margaret DeMaribus reporting from Savanga. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Anne Bryce in Sitka, and Margaret DeMaribus in Savanga. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtec.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtec. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.